Welcome to Fully Vetted, animal care news from the clinic to the farm, presented by the Ohio Veterinary Medical Association. And here is your host, Mia Cunningham, and producer, Kristen Bennett. Thanks for joining us today. We're glad to be back with you for episode 26 of Fully Vetted. I'm producer and co-host, Kristen Bennett. As you know, Ohio veterinarians are now legally required to report suspected cases of animal abuse. OVMA recently hosted a webinar on the provisions of the new law and what you need to know in order to comply with it. In today's episode, we're sharing excerpts from that webinar to introduce you to the process of reporting and to offer examples of cases you could be confronted with. But first, host Mia Cunningham has a special invitation for OVMA members interested in developing their leadership skills.
Hello and welcome back. I'm your host, Mia Cunningham, and I'm here today to bring special attention to the OVMA's Power of 10 program. Formerly known as the OVMA Leadership Development Program, the Power of 10 will launch May 19th, 2021. This new program will cultivate participants' unique leadership style through a series of virtual seminars from May to September of 2021. A total of 13 hours of online, non-scientific CE are achievable to those who participate. The OVMA Power of 10 consists of 5 focus sessions on the following topics. We'll start off with Insights Discovery and Assessment Training with Dr. Heidi Hulon. Then we move on to a Well-Being Boot Camp with Dr. Elizabeth Strand. Next, we'll get comfortable getting uncomfortable with Dr. Mia Carey. From there, we'll move on to Leadership and Advocacy in Veterinary Medicine with OVMA Executive Director Jack Advent and OVMA Government Relations Director Michael Costella. We'll finish the program with a leadership and emotional intelligence session with Dr. Michelle Harkey. We're now accepting applications to join this year's cohort. This program is open to all OVMA members at any stage in their career, and there is no fee to participate. In order to qualify for consideration, candidates must be an OVMA member in good standing and commit to volunteering at an OVMA-sponsored event or participate on a planning committee upon program completion. The deadline to apply is Friday, April 30th. All applicants will be notified no later than May 7th regarding their acceptance to the program. For more detailed program information, including complete session descriptions, dates, and times, or to apply or nominate a candidate for program consideration, please visit our website at www.ohiovma.org. Now, I have the pleasure of serving as a staff liaison for this program, so please feel free to contact me with any additional questions or suggestions at mlc@ohiovma.org.
You may remember Dr. Allison Lash from episode 23 on how to differentiate between accidental injuries and animal abuse. For those who are new to the show, Dr. Lash is the medical director of the Cleveland APL and chair of OVMA's Animal Abuse Recognition and Reporting Task Force. She has 10 years of experience in shelter medicine, prior to which she worked in both private practice and emergency relief. In this first segment, Dr. Lash is going to talk about what to report and the process of reporting.
What I would report and what you would report are going to be two different things. We're not always going to see eye to eye, but that's the thing. It's just if you suspect there's something wrong, please report it. So when I approach a potential cruelty case, I always keep a few questions in mind. You know, is there unnecessary discomfort or suffering? Would a reasonable person be able to tell there was a problem? Is there reasonable remedy or relief? Are they seeking that reasonable remedy or relief? And are the owners or caretakers following the agreed upon plan? So that doesn't mean that because they declined referral to repair the fracture that they need to be reported, as long as they're agreeing to a reasonable plan, which it could be splinting, pain medication, or something along those lines. So those are things that I try to keep at the forefront of my mind, because in the end, I know if any of these cases go to court, those are the questions that are going to be asked of me, either in a report or at court. So many forms of animal abuse occur, from minor neglect, that are going to be the majority that we see, to malicious harm, which is fortunately the minority. The big decision is when to educate and when to report. When education fails, and I'm not talking about the malicious cases, if it's malicious, if it's intentional harm, it has to be reported. But when education fails or intentional abuse is suspected, report it. Also, when there's reasonable belief the animal will go without care, report it. So somebody that leaves against medical advice, you know, they told you they had $20 to their name, they left without care, there's reason to believe that animal will go without care. Key considerations are just always human safety first. Don't try to do anything heroic. Don't get in fights with people. Protect yourself and your staff first. This is of the utmost importance. Do we come into contact with people that could be dangerous? Yes. But typically, if people are in there, and I think a lot of you will agree, if you're helping their animal and taking care of their animal, you're on their side at that point. But if there's any concern, call the police, have them come in. And even after reporting, continue to be aware of your safety. I think most people are good and aren't going to do anything. But even where I work, maybe once a year, we'll have a photo of somebody that just says, you know, if this guy approaches you, don't talk to him, don't share any information, and notify an agent. So just remember, keep everyone safe. Treat the animal. Do what you need to do, what you would usually do. And then you're not the judge or jury. You're not there to determine whether this person's guilty or innocent. You're there to document and recognize suspected abuse. And that's all we're asking. Are you going to report something that someone else doesn't think is abuse? Mm-hmm. Have I? Absolutely. And it is. It's not always clear cut. Avoid bias. And this isn't an exact science. There is so much gray. And the gray part is the trickiest part to navigate through. What I think people might have questions about: owners leaving against medical advice, unable to pay for care, or refusal to euthanize. I think all of us have had all of these scenarios. So people may leave for a variety of reasons. They might not have the money. They might not want to pay the money. They might not see the issue that you see. They might not agree with a treatment plan. There could be cultural religious differences. So first, the money issue. None of us are doing this to get rich. We all want to treat animals. So how do we try to be proactive about the money issue? How do we deal with they can't treat because of the money issue? Ways that we can help are like we do every day. You present a variety of treatment options. We present everything from surgical fixation of the leg to splinting it, making sure it stays on pain medication. If it's possible, you know, seeing if your practice can offer some financing for these extreme cases where, you know, it's a good person, they just are in a bind with something that cannot wait. So I always think of pios, parvo, and fractures. And they can't afford treatment where you work, and they say they're going to go to, you know, practice B, and I call the practice and just see if they went. And if they didn't, then I report them. If they did, then good. So don't hesitate to call and to have those good relationships with each other to make sure someone showed up where they should. Know your local resources as well. And this is a time to reach out. It's never the time when you're in that crisis mode, but know your local resources. Like where I work at an animal shelter. We work with a couple local emergency clinics, and you know, they'll text me and say, you know, we had a pio come in, the owner didn't have any money, can you guys do something? But we have an income qualified program where we offer either X amount of money toward the medical care of an animal or provide the medical care for the animal, as long as the people are income qualified. And then lastly, there are some programs that do offer financial assistance, whether it's short-term loans, or sometimes they'll just help outright pay for something. And then there's also some low-cost clinics. And then also knowing local shelters, could they surrender their animal? So in the end, when you have done what you can, and you still have reasonable belief they are not going to seek care, and the animal will experience unnecessary pain and suffering, report it. And sometimes it's as easy as the officer just showing up and saying, look, did you go get treatment for the pyometra your dog had? And they'll say, oh yeah, I went and got her spayed and she's fine. And then they know the animal's getting treatment and everyone can sleep well at night. Refusal to euthanize. So that alone is not grounds for medical neglect. And a lot of people don't want to euthanize. And that's okay. But if they don't wish to euthanize, they have to continue to provide their animal care and be under the agreed upon treatment plan. You know, I always call it the agreed upon treatment plan because it has to be the one that we reach together and not necessarily the gold standard, but the one that we have come down to that for us to keep moving forward, this is what we're going to do. And again, if you've done all you can and you still have reasonable belief that either you can't keep this animal comfortable no matter what you do, or the owner is refusing what you're recommending to keep the animal comfortable, report. So I reported it. What happens now? So few reports actually proceed to court. I would say the vast majority of cases I see, and I see a lot, end with just my physical exam and photos. That's the vast majority of them. The next subset of them results in the officer educating them. Sometimes there's a compliance agreement put in place. You know, maybe they have to surrender their animal or they have to get what treatment was recommended by a certain date. Education compliance agreements happen quite a bit. And then less commonly, charges are filed. So when charges are filed, it still does not mean that you're going to be asked to go to court. It doesn't even mean that you'll be asked for an expert statement. So after charges are filed, then the person that's charged with cruelty has the option of reaching a plea agreement, which circles back to typically a compliance agreement and some restitution. And the other option is going to go to court. We go to court so infrequently. Out of the thousands of animals that I have seen, I could probably count on one hand how many times I've testified in court. The number of times I've gone to court and then just to sit around and wait and then a plea agreement's reached, maybe a dozen times. Really, everyone works to settle these things before they go to court. When you're asked for an expert report, this is in addition to the medical records and diagnostics. Keep it concise. You know this stuff. You got this. You have to keep in mind your audience. It's not veterinarians. It's not medical people. It's attorneys. It's a judge. They're going to be reading what you write. Make sure non-medical folks understand what you're saying. You know, if they don't understand what you're saying, it can lose the power of what you're trying to convey. What we're looking to see is describing the animal, describing your exam. And again, they'll get the records as well. But then what the courts want to know is, did this animal suffer? Did it needlessly suffer? You know, typically the answer is yes, no. And you can usually summarize that pretty easily. In a lot of my writing, I put any reasonable person or that there's reasonable remedy or relief for the issue. You know, if called upon further, we can bring all of our medical stuff along. But a lot of these, even after you write a report, it's usually enough that the person knows that going to trial is not a good idea. Testifying. So in the rare event that you will testify, it is not the scariest thing in the world. I have never been treated with anything other than respect. So you are the expert. You will be treated like the expert. A lot of yes, no questions. You're typically asked for a resume. So those of you that have been doing this for, you know, 15 or 20 years, like I have, might want to get one ready. Just have one there just in case, because the last thing you want to be doing is like working on a resume when you're in a pinch. Answer the questions. Take your time. It's not a rush. It is okay to say, I don't know, or I'm not certain, or I didn't see that. Ask for clarification if you need it, and also bring whatever was submitted for evidence. So the medical record, you could have copies of x-rays, copy of your report, and have them handy, but they had to have been submitted in advance. You can't just walk in with new materials. And I typically ask if I can refer to my notes if I need to. Typically, notes need to be referred to when you have like larger scale cases with a lot of animals.
In the following segment, Dr. Lash is going to share examples of actual cases of animal abuse. You can find links to the photos from these cases, as well as other resources, in the show notes.
So a cat with severe bilateral entropion, untreated, cat's 3 years old, and he's been owned for 3 years. So, you know, after surgery, things ended up fine, and the cat has gone on to do just fine. Did they seek care in a timely fashion? No. Could this be reported and prosecuted? It absolutely could. This one wasn't reported. And the reason it wasn't is the cat was surrendered because of the condition to the shelter. So it's just kind of a different scenario than maybe you'd be in. But if you were presented with this cat in private practice and they said, I've owned this cat for 3 years, his eyes have been like this for 3 years, we've never done anything. That is something that's concerning and something that does warrant further conversation with the owner, maybe a call to your local shelter or a law enforcement officer. This is a dog with a tumor that grew over the course of a year. The owner has owned it 1 year. Although the tumor is ugly, it wasn't painful, it wasn't uncomfortable, and you know, no action was taken. This is a dog that came in matted. The owner's had it all of its life. It's a young adult. When I see matted dogs, they run the gamut of whether you report them or not. This one fortunately didn't have any other issues other than just really gross matted hair. So no, that dog was not reported. When there's limb strangulation, when they're losing a limb or have to lose a limb because of the matting, there's usually an odor associated with that that I would think a reasonable person should have been able to identify to get that taken care of. This is an example of a dog that has strangulated limb. You can see the matting isn't severe. It's just kind of that cottony, fluffy fur. But around the legs, it got a little bad. That front leg was almost not salvageable. So this one did get reported and charges were filed because there was limb damage and limb strangulation occurring. But fortunately, with time and medicine, everything ended up okay. This is a little pup. little pit mix puppy that has Demodex. Didn't just happen yesterday. There's been plenty of time for that to develop. The question is do I report it? So again, it couples with the history. If the person says, I just found this dog walking down the street, it looks like this, you know, it's a client you've had for years. No, I wouldn't. I would just get to work and start treating. You know, if the person said, I've had this dog for 2 months, it's been like this most of the time I've had it. I've tried motor oil. It didn't work. What should I do, doc? That I would report. So this is an animal where a non-accidental injury is suspected, and it came in, owner presented a 4-month-old pit mix that he gave it a routine bath 2 days ago. And his story was he takes a shower, and at the end of his shower, he plugs the drain and allows the water to fill, and then he bathes the puppy. He did this 2 days ago, and then the puppy came in and had some burns to it. So again, does the presentation of the animal match the story? Absolutely not. There's no way a human was standing in water that was this hot. Do I have to prove anything? Do I have to argue with him? No. We start treating the dog, document, photo, and submit this to the appropriate agency. And this is little Phoenix after. I've shared the after, so it looks happy. So she ended up just fine. Another case of neglect suspected. Adult pit bull mix left in a hot car. You know, being stupid isn't necessarily a crime. At least it was acknowledged and found out. But then we saw Westy and body condition scores 1 out of 9. Being left in a hot car wasn't his issue. When I see cases like this, I don't even care what the underlying issue is. It doesn't even matter. There's no reason this dog should look like this. He isn't a dog under medical treatment for anything. He's not a dog that someone, you know, he's an end-stage cancer hospice. It was just found in a hot car. So he is a dog I would absolutely report based on his body condition in addition to the hot car. Dog fighting, a lot of times people that fight dogs tend to treat by themselves. They tend to have their own little pharmacy and supplies, suture kits, you name it. I don't think we see a ton of them. We might receive information that someone's fighting dogs or that somebody has some information, but it's not incredibly common they're going to walk through your door, but you may see them. So when you get dogs from dog fighting cases, I think the thing I see most often is the distribution pattern of bite wounds is typically face and front legs. So when you're looking at a fighting dog versus two housemates that got in a fight, you know, the two housemates that got in a fight, they probably have some penetrating wounds, maybe on their ears, maybe around their neck, but they don't have the old wounds. So you can see this dog has not only fresh wounds, but wounds at different stages. There's wounds that are scarred down from old fights. There's ones that are in the process of healing. And then there's some a little bit fresher. So that is very classic for a history of intentional, encouraged fighting. Other things you might see, a lean dog, but really well muscled, big, thick chains, big, thick collars. And then also if you end up doing diagnostics tests, any dog that I have a report that has been fighting or has suspicious wounds suggestive of fighting, we run tests for babesia. And some of the client things you might see is they might only pay in cash. They might be a little arrogant and want to do things themselves. Maybe you won't get a lot of information. They might not see too emotional that their dog's torn up. I think when we see two house dogs or two companions or two dogs from the dog park that got in a fight, people are in hysterics, even, you know, if it's a tiny wound. So a scar chart is completed for any dog that comes in that has a reported history or wounds suggestive of dog fighting. You do red marks for recent injuries, blue ones indicate scars. And it's very helpful when you take this to court, you have pictures of the dog after it healed, you have your initial photos, your scar charts, and your after photos. It seems like anything that has sustained blunt force trauma, they come in saying it was hit by a car. This comes a point where it gets very challenging, and sometimes it's upon us to sort those out of was it hit by a car or was it intentional abuse. So here is a dog that was reported to have been hit by a car. The owner came in with a deceased puppy, 2.5 months old, Boston Terrier that was hit by a car. All right, that can happen. I mean, they can run out and get loose. 2.5 months, kind of strange, but sure. So any animals that have a unknown cause of death, and also whenever there's a report of malice, I end up doing a full body x-rays to look for fractures. One of the classic things when you're differentiating non-accidental injury from accidental injury is old injuries with new injuries. So this puppy not only had a new fractured rib, but older fractured ribs. And in addition, this puppy also had, when you reflect the skin on the top of the head, there was a lot of hemorrhage and bruising. And that's another classic feature of non-accidental injury is injury to different parts of the body. The distribution doesn't make sense from being hit by a car. So in this puppy's short life, you know, this guy had not only ended its life, but had already been beating the dog. And the girlfriend had a suspicion, and that's what led to us further investigating this. And animal hoarding, and I think you might come across this a little bit more than you might realize, and I think these are really tricky ones. So this is a classic cat from a hoarder. It's a juvenile cat, thin, almost emaciated, upper respiratory infection, evidence of chronic URI, dirty. I wish you could smell through this, but the odor of old excrement and urine. And cats are clean animals. It is darn hard to have a dirty young cat. So then the owner kind of smells like cat pee. The carrier's dirty. I'm not talking like just sitting in the garage dirty, but like caked on goo dirty. And, you know, I typically ask people, how long have you had this cat? And this person's answer, 2 years. Okay, so she's had it its whole life. She didn't just find it outside yesterday. You know, you start to think about it. They rarely bring in the same cat. It's usually kind of a cat that looks like this. And then what I call the hoarder question is I ask, how many cats do you have? So if someone asks me how many cats I have, you know, Allison, how many cats do you have? I have 5. And the hoarder answer is typically, and it starts off, well, you know, I have 4 that live downstairs and, you know, 6 that have to stay upstairs, and I'm watching 12 of my son's cats. And when they just start going down that path, either they don't know how many cats they have, or they're embarrassed to tell you. Oftentimes that warrants reporting. When you see a cat like this, you're getting that weird vibe, you're getting those weird answers. And I always tell people, you know, how many cats can I have? I don't know. We're not the numbers police. It's how many can you take care of? So this was from a case where there were 105 cats living in an RV, and there were 2 humans living in this RV with these cats. So I think most people would agree that that's too many cats. Amazingly, a lot of them pretty clear-eyed and healthy, but what you can't see, and again, I wish you could smell, even the cats that look like they're in good conditions stunk, and they stunk for probably a week before that smell got off of them. When it comes to hoarders, they fail to provide minimum standards of care. They're failing to even acknowledge the deteriorating conditions around them or the dying animals around them. Sadly, I think most hoarders have really good intention, but it's when that good intention turns into unsustainable lifestyle for both them and the animals. And that does warrant a report. And I know it might be the nicest person, but in the end, you're helping not only the animals, but also the person. No human should be living in that.
That's all for today's episode, but we'll continue our discussion of animal abuse next time. Thanks again for joining us today, and a shout out to Dr. Lash for her informational presentation. To view the webinar in its entirety, please see the link in the show notes. In our next episode, we'll continue our spotlight on animal abuse reporting with answers to some frequently asked questions. We hope you'll join us again in 2 weeks.
Thanks for tuning in. Until next time, stay safe and be well.
The Ohio Veterinary Medical Association is always seeking ways to enrich your member experience. To access resources mentioned in this episode, share your feedback and suggestions, and send us an email or voice message, please visit www.fullyvettedpodcast.com. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever you prefer to listen so you never miss an episode. I'm Kristen Bennett, and on behalf of the OVMA, thanks for listening to Fully Vetted. We'll see you next time.